a war of words at the UN for Israel and Iran.
Israel is not the boy who cried wolf. We have been screaming from the rooftops for years.
The Israeli Prime Minister's policy seeks to expand and escalate the conflict in the region to stay in power.
A one-year anniversary of the war in Sudan.
From day one of Sudan's war a year ago, fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces.
And how many drones can you control at the same time?
A single human can manage a swarm of 100 or more autonomous drones and ground robots.
Today is Monday, April 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israel and Iran condemned each other's actions during a tense United Nations Security Council on Sunday.
Why have you not used all possible means to condemn Iran and demand compliance? Why have you instead rolled out the red carpet for these genocidal jihadists? Why do you treat them as if they are interested in de-escalation when you know that the opposite is true?
That was Israel's ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan. He was countered by Iran's ambassador to the UN, Saeed Erivani.
These countries, especially the United States, have shielded Israel from any responsibility for the Gaza massacre, while they have denied Iran's inherent right to self-defense against the Israeli armed attack on our diplomatic premises. At the same time, they shamefully justified the Israeli massacre and genocide against the defenseless Palestinian people under the pretext of self-defense.
Iran launched a swarm of explosive drones and fired missiles on Saturday in its first ever attack on Israeli territory, risking a major escalation. U.S. President Joe Biden warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States would not take part in a counteroffensive against Iran, according to a White House official. Details on this now from Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam.
U.S. President Joe Biden and other leaders of the G7 nations condemned Iran's attack on Israel on Sunday, saying it risked provoking an uncontrollable regional escalation. A White House official said Biden warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. will not take part in a counteroffensive against Iran if Israel decides to retaliate after Iran launched an overnight barrage of missiles and drones on Israeli territory. Meanwhile, Netanyahu reconvened a war cabinet meeting in Tel Aviv to discuss a response to the drone and missile attack. War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz warned that Israel would, quote, exact the price from Iran in a fashion and timing that is right for us. Iran's armed forces chief said the operation was considered successful and, quote, deemed the matter concluded. But Iran warned Israel and the U.S. that a retaliation to its overnight attack would elicit a far bigger response. The Israeli army released footage on Sunday that it said showed its fighter jets intercepting unmanned aerial vehicles and cruise missiles launched from Iran. The more than 300 missiles and drones mostly launched from inside Iran caused only modest damage in Israel, as most were shot down with the help of the U.S., the U.K., and Jordan. An Air Force base in southern Israel was hit but continued to operate as normal, and a 7-year-old child was seriously hurt by shrapnel. There were no other reports of injuries or serious damage. Despite the minimal damage, Barbara Slavin, a distinguished Middle East fellow at the Stimson Center, called the attack on Israel a paradigm shift.
The shadow war between Israel and Iran is now out in the open. But given that, Iran did it in a very calibrated way, sending these slow drones, hours and hours flying from Iran to Israel, giving plenty of time for the Israelis and the United States and others to prepare. I mean, even the Jordanians shot down a bunch of these drones as they went over Jordanian airspace. Thank God no one was killed. It doesn't appear that there was very much damage. So it was kind of performative, but it was nevertheless a paradigm shift because it was a direct Iranian retaliation on Israel for Israeli attacks on Iranians.
Iran's attack was over a suspected Israeli strike on its consulate in Syria that killed top military commanders It also followed months of clashes between Israel and Iran's regional allies, triggered by the war in Gaza. The threat of open warfare erupting between Iran and Israel and dragging the United States into it has put the region on edge. It also triggered calls for restraint to avoid further escalation from global powers including Russia, China, France, and Germany, as well as Arab nations, Egypt, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Turkey also warned Iran it did not want further tension in the region.
Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam. It has now been a year since war broke out in Sudan. Analysts foresee no end to the conflict and say the longer it drags on, the more likely Sudan will become a breeding ground for terrorist groups. VOA spoke via video to a volunteer at one of the last functioning hospitals in Omdurman. Henry Wilkins reports.
From day one of Sudan's war a year ago, fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces has ravaged Sudan's twin cities of Khartoum, its capital, and Omdurman, its largest. Millions have fled the metropolitan area because of the fighting. Some have stayed, however. Momen Ahmed Abbas volunteers at one of Omdurman's last functional hospitals and refuses to flee the city.
I cannot abandon them, especially when they rely on my support. Thus, I remain to ensure that injured individuals have access to essentials like food, shelter, and medical care.
He says the situation is desperate at the hospital, which lacks medical supplies and security, and is vulnerable to frequent airstrikes and fighting. Humanitarian groups and international journalists have found entry into Khartoum and many other parts of Sudan all but impossible. And as a result, the world's awareness of the country's troubles has diminished. Commentators and diplomats often refer to Sudan's conflict as the world's forgotten war. Analysts say pressure from the international community is needed to bring the warring sides to the negotiating table. But one doesn't see that happening anytime soon.
Sadly, I don't see this conflict as particularly ripe for any kind of resolution right now. Both sides think either that they can win or they have to win. And as long as they continue to be sustained by external actors, providing them weapons and intelligence, then they're going to continue this fight.
A recent U.S. intelligence report says the longer the war drags on, the more likely Sudan will become a breeding ground for terrorists. One analyst who spoke to VOA echoed this view.
You got young people and they have all the fuel. They have the anger, they have the ethnic division, and then they have whatever is the narrative about there is a just war happening somewhere.
After 1 year of fighting in Sudan, it seems clear that no substantial help is on its way. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. A fire raged out of control in the mountains of Tarbini in Spain's Alicante province, leading authorities to evacuate 180 people Sunday from their homes. Spain has experienced unseasonal high temperatures for April, with many places marking 10 degrees centigrade higher than normal. At least 14 people have been killed in landslides on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi. Landslides triggered by high-intensity rains affected two villages in the region of Tana Toraja in South Sulawesi, destroying four homes. It was the Day of the Dog on Sunday in Cuba. Animal rights protectors held the traditional pilgrimage demanding stricter legislation to combat animal cruelty. Accompanied by their pets, the activists walked through Havana's Colon Cemetery with flowers and posters. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president is set to begin this week in New York City. Donald Trump's hush money case will start on Monday with jury selection. Separately, President Joe Biden, who is seeking re-election, will hit the campaign trail in Pennsylvania. VOA's Veronica Valderas Iglesias has details.
The battleground state of Pennsylvania was the last election campaign stop for Donald Trump ahead of his hush money trial on Monday in New York. He faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records, allegedly to hide a 2006 sexual encounter with porn star Stormy Daniels. During Saturday's rally in Schnecksville, the presumptive Republican presidential candidate once again decried the case as a witch hunt.
They're all Biden trials, you know that, right? And I'm proud to do it for you. Have a good time watching.
Since this will be the first criminal trial ever of a former president, the case will indeed be under scrutiny, noted political analyst Calvin Dark.
I believe that so far the judges, for the most part, have judges and the prosecutors, have done a really good job in trying to make sure that the treatment that Trump gets is as close as possible to what the average American would expect if they were in a similar situation.
Appearing Sunday on ABC's This Week, the governor of New Hampshire, Republican Chris Sununu, said he doesn't expect the hush money trial will have major political ramifications for Trump.
He'll probably go back on the campaign trail and almost like rehash what's going on. He'll try to victimize it, and that has worked for him.
Bless you all.
President Joe Biden's attention, meanwhile, has been fully engaged in the response to Saturday's attack by Iran on Israel. But he's also expected to hit the campaign trail this coming week with a three-day visit to Pennsylvania. The main talking point, the economy. Carlin Bowman is a senior fellow emeritus at the American Enterprise Institute. She spoke to VOA via Skype.
He's going to be talking about the fact that there's some indications of improvement in the economy, although the inflation report list last week was not a good one for the administration.
Another topic that the Biden campaign has been boosting and could continue to focus on this week is the protection of reproductive rights, especially after Trump said last week that the decision on abortion should be left to the states. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
India's most popular state, Uttar Pradesh, holds the key to securing a victory in India's upcoming general elections. Anjana Pashrisha found strong support for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party in the battleground state as the country prepares to head to the polls in a phased election that will last for 6 weeks starting April 19th.
Krishan Pal says profits from his one-hectare farm in India's northern Uttar Pradesh state have dwindled due to rising costs of inputs such as pesticides. Pal said the government is not looking at the expenses we incur. It is not helping farmers. He will still back Prime Minister Narendra Modi's ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party or BJP. Pal said he supports the BJP because this is a nation of Hindus. Hindus should stay in power. In villages and towns in India's most populous state, issues such as falling incomes, high unemployment, and rising prices are talking points as elections approach. Mohammed Ashraf says his milk supplying business has shrunk due to competition from young, jobless people who are entering the same line of work. Ashraf questions what the government has done during its 10-year rule. But in the battleground state that chooses 80 out of 543 elected lawmakers in the lower house of parliament, such issues are on the back burner. Staunch support for BJP is the overwhelming sentiment. It's fueled by the party's ideology that seeks to establish a Hindu national identity and improved governance. Kapil Tyagi, a farmer in Uttar Pradesh, said the government is working well. His village has seen good development. A water tank has been installed and the electricity supply is regular. A grand temple inaugurated in January in the state's Ayodhya town in honor of Hindu god Ram has also cemented Modi's popularity in the Hindu majority nation. Nirja Chaudhary is a political analyst.
He's seen as the king of Hindu hearts.
Launching his campaign from the state, Modi expressed confidence about getting re-elected. Modi said His government has already started work for its third term. We are preparing the roadmap for the next 5 years. Anjana Pasricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. After 10 years, the world has largely forgotten about the Chibok girls who were kidnapped by Nigeria's Boko Haram Islamist militants. But four victims and their families, like Solomon Maina, who is still waiting for news about his daughter, the tragedy is still real. Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan has more.
My daughter. I'm sorry.
Solomon Maina's daughter, Deborah, was one of the 276 schoolgirls kidnapped from their dormitory in the middle of the night by Nigeria's Boko Haram Islamist militants 10 years ago.
Bring back our girls!
Global outrage was swift. The Bring Back Our Girls campaign drew support from the likes of Michelle Obama and Sylvester Stallone. Then in 2016 and 2017, negotiations led to the highly publicized liberation of around 100 captives. Deborah was not one of them. A decade on from the abduction, the world has largely forgotten the plight of the Chibok girls. But for Maina, the tragedy is ongoing.
I am anytime thinking, even for example at night, I am thinking that, oh, this is my daughter. Where is she now? Where is she now? Is she in a comfortable place or what kind of place that she's living? This is any time I'm thinking in this way.
Abductees who have returned home have struggled to resume their lives. Some are raising children fathered by their captors. Others have waited years for funds promised by the government to continue their education. Yagana Yamani is one of the liberated captives. She waited for government funds for 6 years after escaping her captors. She finally asked her mother, a farmer, to help. Now 25, she is studying public health.
And after secondary school, they say that even master's degree, everything they will do for us. But after that secondary school, we didn't see anything again. Nobody called us that this girl has graduated from secondary school. Let us take us for the university or other school. No. They didn't fulfill their promise.
Dozens freed only in the past few years are living inside a military-run rehabilitation camp with surrender Boko Haram fighters they married in the bush. That's according to the Murtala Muhammad Foundation, a charity that advocates for them. Three of the surviving women told Reuters that in at least five cases, women who arrived at the camp unmarried have been married to surrendered fighters once there. Family members say government officials have officiated over such weddings in an apparent effort to appease the surrendered fighters. Mohammed Maina is a program officer for the foundation.
I can say they're still married, like with the contact they hold in the forest. So they're still holding to that tie, to that bond. And I don't know, maybe after they were fully released into the society, they will do a proper wedding with the blessings of their parents. Because I believe some of them, their parents have not yet blessed the marriage.
The state official in charge of the rehabilitation project did not respond to a Reuters request for comment. Roughly 90 Chibok girls are still missing. Based on the accounts of former abductees, the Murtala Muhammad Foundation believes a third of those have died in captivity.
Those that remain in the bush, that are my friends. Also, I was praying. Maybe one day we'll still see each other.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. And finally, so I have to be honest. I've tried to fly a drone. It's really hard. A single drone. But the U.S. military says large groups of drones and ground robots can be managed by just one person without added stress to the operator. As VOA's Julie Tabo reports, the technologies may be beneficial not only for the military, but for civilian uses as well.
Field experiments at a government training facility demonstrate that a single human can manage a swarm of 100 or more autonomous drones and ground robots without added stress, according to the U.S. Defense Department's research agency, DARPA. The swarm commander uses a virtual reality interface to deploy and monitor the vehicles within a 10-block simulated environment. Their mission? To navigate the urban environment, avoiding obstacles and power lines to collect intelligence. Julie A. Adams is Associate Director of Research at Collaborative Robotics and Intelligence Systems Institute at Oregon State University, which collaborated with DARPA on the program.
The swarm commander can basically hit a single button to issue multiple tactics to the swarm so that the swarm can go out and do the things that it's supposed to do.
The findings show potential for military as well as civilian purposes, such as sending out drones to respond to natural disasters.
The long-term dream goal is actually to be able to have heterogeneous teams of robots working alongside teams of humans in something like wildland fire response or disaster response.
Drones can also be used, and in fact are already being used, for speedier package deliveries.
Currently, the FAA regulations limit how many vehicles a single individual can supervise in doing these kinds of tasks, the directions of the delivery drone companies.
The program is still in development, but researchers say their findings may quickly have impacts overseas as well as in the U.S. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. You can also download the VOA app. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world is inevitably growing increasingly digitalized. Today, some 7 billion digital devices are connected to the Internet of Things. Next year, that number is expected to rise to 22 billion, according to the United Nations. Advancements in cyber technology can bring enormous benefits. And yet, our increasing reliance on these technologies makes us vulnerable to cybercrime. International law applies in cyberspace and offers guidance and norms on how states can act responsibly, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the UN, Linda Thomas Greenfield. That includes an expectation that states investigate and mitigate malicious cyber activity emanating from their territory and aimed at the critical infrastructure of another.
We have seen a significant spike in ransomware attacks on hospitals and healthcare organizations here in the United States, causing disruptions to everything from prescription refills to vital surgeries. And yet, despite the expectation that states investigate ransomware actors on their soil, some members, most notably Russia, have looked the other way or worse, empowered those malicious actors.
Several other countries also sponsor malicious cyber attacks. One such is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea. UN investigators found that the DPRK is most likely responsible for 17 cyber attacks last year that netted the thieves some $750 million. Those heists follow 58 similar suspected DPRK cyber attacks in the 6 years prior, with cryptocurrency companies counting some $3 billion in losses, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
And let's be clear, it's not just that this money was stolen. Revenues from the DPRK's cyber operations, including work to steal or launder foreign currency, directly funds its unlawful WMD and ballistic missile programs.
Increasingly, non-state actors are also raising the stakes. Previously, this technology was prohibitively expensive to acquire and prohibitively complex to develop and deploy, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. Now, malicious actors can readily and easily purchase powerful capabilities at an increasingly low cost.
This growing marketplace of more affordable, accessible, and advanced commercial cyber tools, including commercial spyware, is already changing the cyber landscape, making it harder for the international community to hold parties accountable for bad behavior and introducing new instability to cyberspace.
There is no separating what happens in cyberspace from what happens in the real world. The two are inextricably linked, and cybersecurity is international security, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. The United States is working with like-minded countries to highlight and condemn disruptive, destructive, and destabilizing behavior in cyberspace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.